handmade object. And so people are starting, almost everyone respects a good handmade basket. I mean, you know, from the top of the line right on down to the bottom of, you know, the economic totem pole or whatever. So if you can produce a, you know, respectable looking handmade object, even if it's a little abstract and weird crazy baskets like they call them down my way, if it's well made, you know, people, now that's pretty, that crazy basket, that's pretty, you know. So there's I think people just respect good handcraft.
I know there is a lot of that down there. There's a good, there's a high amount of respect for something, even if it's unusual, if it's well done.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
I live in near Asheville, North Carolina. Burnsville. Mm-hmm.
Well, another question that relates to this whole thing we've been talking about is the question of handcraft versus power, or the use of tools other than the traditional, the old hand tools. And I've heard you all say that you do most of your work by hand, but do you do any... use any tools or any processes in your work that you've added to it that doesn't come out of the tradition somehow? Doug, what about you?
I was from the time I was a little kid, my dad showed me how to use electric drill. So to me, an electric drill, I mean, I almost, why do you use those hand drills, you know? I mean, so to me, if I need a hole in a basket, I just go for the electric drill. I mean, I can go be pure and, you know, do that. I remember Paul Goode showing me he had a leather punch. Not electric leather punch, but leather punch is used. This ain't exactly old timey, buddy, but they work good, and we've been using that in the basket class. It works great. And I pretty much use what's available. Now there are times when a machine made object is not the thing. A lot of these Adirondack pack baskets that you buy in the L.L. Bean and all are made with birch veneer. Now, birch veneer works, and you can get it, and you can fold it up, and you can make it into a basket. And a lot of the more commercial baskets are made that way, with veneer. Now, veneer, I'm sure you can tell us about that. It just has none of the strength and the holding power that a well-made splint has. I mean, a splint, you're dealing with the integrity of the wood. Veneer means just rolled off a log and cut into strips. So, and that's
no comparison. No.
Yeah.
The only, I use chainsaw. That's the only modern piece I use. My dad used an axe. Well, my dad took the axe. He carried the axe. And we found the trees. And now, boys? Give you a little story. Some of you have read basket books. And in some of the books, it'll say, don't cut the white oak a certain time of the year. Don't cut it on the north side of the slope. My dad was a firm believer in this. And he would go out, and he would... we'd cut three pieces on the side of the slope, but on the way out, on the wrong side of the slope, we'd see a couple of nice pieces. But he'd say, no, no good. We'd go all the way around the other side, and we'd cut them. We'd cut them all the way back. Dad'd put them open, it'd be no good. He said, well, boys, I'm too tired. You two boys go back and get us another one. So my brother and I go right back to the ones on the wrong side of the cut them. Take them back. Dad said, boy, how did I miss those? They really work good. So, and the only thing that the reason that I don't, he had an old, what do you call it?
Crosscut saw?
No, it was one man buck.
Bow saw?
Buck saw or something like that. I do a lot of classes, and I'd still be using a crosscut, but I can't seem to get these women that I have in the class to get on the other end of that crosscut saw. And when we fell a tree in the mountain out there, there can be 12 or 20 of them standing around that'll take pictures.
When I say, now,
we're going to carry it out, 20 people can disappear the quickest. How
about the freezer, Bill? No.
I'm the only man probably, well, no, there's a lot of them that's picked it up, but I'm probably the one that started it. You freeze everything now, you know, you have cooking in bags, everything's frozen, meat's frozen. Well, I'm the only guy that has a 6-foot chest freezer in his workshop full of white oak. But I think it penetrated over to some of the other basket makers. Tom, are you doing that?
No, I'm not doing it, but I'm...
you want to try? The reason for that is certain parts of these baskets, the wood has to be in the green stage. So if you make, I don't like to soak it because it's just like if you take an old sponge that's dried up and just drop it down a pail of water. What will happen? It'll swell up. Well, you throw it back out, it dries back. Same thing will happen with the weavers of white oak. If you soak them, they'll swell up. And you weave the basket, and if you don't let it sit and tighten it up, it'll get all loose later on. So there's certain parts that have to be kept moist. You can dry them and then go back and wet them a little bit. But I found years and years ago that if you make them and you put them in the freezer, you take them out of the freezer, it takes about 5 minutes for them to thaw up, and any shape you bend them in, they stay. You can just, if I want to make a flower vase, you can go up so far, bend it a little further, and they stay in that shape. Now, I don't know whether it's freeze-dried or... it's terrific.
That's a form of technology that your ancestors didn't have available to you.
So if you're going through Virginia and you would like a pound of white oak out of the freezer...
there's a fellow in our neighborhood that makes these kind of baskets, and he has in his workshop two freezers. And what he does with the bark is the thing with this kind of thing, you really can only gather this at a certain time of the year, you know, basically in the early part of the growing season. And he takes them and he just takes them before he's folded them up and just puts one inside another inside another inside another inside in plastic bags. He has two freezers, pops them right in there. And I thought that was innovative.
In the round? What?
In the round. Oh, and that way you pack them right in.
It does cause, to come back to a point where Tom said he lives, what, a half mile?
It's about a quarter mile.
Well, I'm a half mile off of Route 11. I'm right in between Interstate 81 and Route 11, which is, it's a mile between them, and I'm sitting right in between them. But I'm right, I can make two steps out of the front door and be in 653, which is a hard surface road. But I have lots of people in covering the area that I've covered that'll be going on vacation. And I was thinking about this when you said somebody stops at the store and comes up. But even though I have an unlisted phone number, I pass out lots of cards. And somebody out of Ohio, Indiana, or just picked those from random, don't get offended, they'll be going on vacation. I work, my hours are usually from 5 in the morning until 11 at night. I read the paper and then I go to bed. So 2 o'clock, the phone rings and they say, Mr. Cook, are you up? We're going down to Florida on vacation. Can we stop in and buy a basket? What are you going to say? So then they come
nothing
down.
Nothing printable.
You know, you just sit and you tell. You get up and you. I have never had anybody that comes past that they don't always buy a bunch of baskets when they do that. But that's just my nature. I get up. But what really to come back to, sometimes they'll come down and the guy will say, well, now, Mr. Cook, I'm fooling with a little bit of this baskets along. You wouldn't happen to have a few pieces of these ribs or something laying around that you can, well, let me have, which, you know, I say, yeah. So can't you picture it? 2 o'clock in the morning, I lift the freezer up, I say, yeah, here, you know, and with the freezer full of white oak. But it does work, wonderful.
That's probably one thing, backing up a little bit, you talking about your dad saying you can't cut them on a certain side of the tree. I had an interesting experience. We were teaching a workshop in the community, and the guy who got us started making baskets was taking the workshop with us. Now, there was like a time span where we had developed our craft. Mm-hmm. And he was taking the workshop with us. And we were at another fellow's house who was also taking the class, and they had gone out and cut a white oak. And we were talking about splitting it. And and they were getting ready to split it, and they were trying to decide which end they were going to split it from. And the older fellow there said, well, Grandpa always said split it from the butt end. And then they turned to me and asked me which end I split it from. And I said, well, sometimes I split it from this end, and sometimes I split it from that end. And he says, well, Grandpa said you always split it from the butt end. And I said, well, why? And he goes, back then, you didn't ask why.
You just got a lot to do with tradition.
Yeah, I think that's has a lot to do with tradition. And they didn't ask why. But now, you get in the workshop and everybody asks why.
Right. You better try and figure an answer.
Yeah.
Some kind. What about your use of traditional methods and tools or modifications or new things that you... Your baskets are moving away from traditional styles. Does that, do you feel that sort of frees you up to do whatever you want in the way of process with them?
As far as process goes, we use all hand tools.
Our materials and process are all very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
The largest part of our work is hand split wide oak, which we do using all traditional tools. I guess there's a few tools we've added, like spring clamps.
Some neat little clippers, and you know, we go to classes and somebody will have a neat pair of hand pruners and we'll go, oh, where'd you get those, you know, and things
so
like that.
So we've added tools like that, but they're all hand tools. I use an electric drill occasionally, but...
propane tank, that's pretty sophisticated. Burn holes in
with a nail and a vice grip, that's
yeah,
pretty
right.
High tech.
Yeah. We decided that was our highest tech tool that we use.
But our methods are traditional, but mm-hmm. we don't really feel bound by tradition in the forms that we create.
Mm.
We like the traditional methods, we like the material you can get using traditional methods.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's
the
no way
yeah.
you can get anything that looks better than hand split white oak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, if there is.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially for that purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's strong and
it's
pretty.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right. What about sharing or passing on your craft other than in this kind of a context? Here we're talking about workshops and, you know, teaching situations, but are you doing anything in any other way that passes on that tradition to other people in your community?
This is something I was thinking about when Bill said something about his daddy, telling him about him. I have these two little kids, one's here and the other one's somewhere. And you were saying that when you were five is when you remembered. And my kids are, you know, right there all the time, and I'm not like, you know, saying... You know, they're too little to say, okay, I'll scrape this or anything, but they have made some baskets. And what I've noticed about them is that Tara, who's six, she knows a lot of stuff. She's in my class sometimes, and if somebody's having trouble, she'll tell them what to do. You know, and six. And using tools, you probably, it's like osmosis. Little kids using tools. You know, him, right there, 3 years old, my sharp knife, my class is going, oh, you know, and Jacob's, you know, he knows how to do it, he's okay, you know, he does this once in a while, he acts stupid, but, you know, as far as how to hold that tool and how to use it, he knows, and I never really, I mean, I guided him a little bit, but there's a lot they're going to know from just osmosis, just going to...
They watch and see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be neat to see what's going to come. Tara says she's going to make baskets.
Uh-huh.
I tell her that's how she's going to get all her transportation, make baskets, and buy your bicycle, and hopefully you'll save up and have a car someday.
Right. Did any of their friends come over and pick it up that way? Come to the house just visiting?
Sometimes there'll be some, you know, a little person will come over and will be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I see them interested, I usually like ask them if they want to help with what's ever going on. And, you know.
So you are passing it along in that way.
And
in
to children, yeah.
Yeah.
Children, and also, you know, anybody that, you know, comes up and wants to talk about it, if I got time, you know, I give it to them.
Uh-huh. Bill, are you passing yours on down the generations?
In my area?
In your family
daughter?
Or in your area?
Well, what she has brought up, in my class I have two boards hanging on the wall, and right in the center of one you'll see a picture of my granddaughter who was 5 years old. And I made the statement to my class this afternoon. I have about 12 knives. She can weave a basket. She's good at it. She can't start the basket. But once we start it and turn it up and get the side on it,
yeah,
she can weave it.
Yeah.
But she uses any knife in my basket shop that I've got. And what's amazing is somebody will walk in the basket shop and she'll be sitting there. She knows how to cut the ends off with a knife. We've really stayed right with her, and she knows how to handle that knife. And she's just been nicked a little bit. But somebody will come into workshop, she'll be sitting there with that 5-inch blade knife that's ready to show me. Go, oh, my God. But it doesn't bother me because, you know, she's been right there every day. We brought her up. And she knows how to use the tools. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like Tara's sitting on the other end of the shaving horse while Tom's making those handles. Someday she's going to sit down there with a piece of wood and make a handle. No one's ever going to teach, you know. No one's ever going to say, okay, this is what you do next. She's just going to know it, which is kind of neat.
Yeah. One of my basket maker friends, she learned from her mother, but she says, Mama never taught me nothing.
Taught
I just wanted to make a basket one day and I made it.
I had this old man come up to a fair once and he was picking up those baskets and he'd go, now, right here, now, you do this and that, you know, and this is how you do this, isn't it, you know, and I'd say, yeah. He'd go, I never made a basket. Then he'd go on, he'd say, well, now, when you do this next. And I'd say, yeah. I'd say, you sure you never made a basket? You know everything. You might have. I could give you a knife and a piece of wood. You'd sit right there and make a basket.
He swore.
No, I couldn't do it.
But his father made a basket.
He'd watch him.
And
he'd watch him run up
there. I mean, he went through the whole process very detailed.
Step by step.
And that man, I could hand him a piece of white oak and he could make a basket. He didn't think he could.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew the whole thing, and he had learned
the longer,
it all. Just
the longer
no
he held
instruction,
those baskets, the longer he looked at it, the more he'd tell us. You know, it was neat.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting.
There are. Tom said that there's not, to Marconi, there's not too many basket makers that you know of around. There are some basket makers throughout the hills and the hollers of West Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and a few years ago we tried to have a meet of nine states of all the basket makers that we could get a hold of in Nashville, North Carolina, at the Guild, where I'm a member of. But some of these people that are up in their 80s, 70, 80, and 90, you won't believe this, but they've never been out of their house. And I went around personally in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and up on the other end toward Cumberland is a couple of old basket makers up in the mountain. But they won't, you can't get them out. They won't leave. They just, if you mention, you know, if you pull out a camera, they're going to run behind and show you. They don't want no pictures. They don't want nothing. And if you say, hey, I'd like for you to come out, and we're going to have a week. Oh, no, I've never been out of this hollow. It's hard to get them out. Mm-hmm. But there are a few of them around. But they're living the life of Raleigh. You make a basket or two, and you see a jug sitting back there with a couple of crossbones on it. You know what that is.
Can't keep that
sassafras.
Sassafras. Right. Yeah. No doubt about it.
Spiked.
Yes. Yeah. You're passing yours on anyway, besides sharing it in workshops?
Yeah, I'd say just anyway.
Just by observation?
Around. Sure.
People come around and watch you?
Sure, sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And admire your work? That helps. I mean, people see this kind of thing. I mean, I think somebody could look at a berry basket like this and puzzle out how it was made and go home and make one if they...
Well,
they'd have to work at shaping it up and making it work.
Most baskets will give away their secrets.
Yeah, they do.
There's a few techniques that I've realized I just really had to learn. Not so much in this sort of stuff, but other kinds of weaving.
Sure. Most baskets. You've used some different techniques in that one case there.
I kind of wanted to talk about
that a little bit.
So here we are in the 20th century, and one of the things that to me it's one of the real beauties of a basket is the functionality of it. And to take a function and elevate it to art form. And so just in my general processing, I'm sort of a little bit of a multi-career person. I do storytelling and I do other kinds of workshops and I'm not quite sure what all, but anyhow. So I decided that, you know, that in case I wanted to hit Wall Street, you know, I would make me a bark mansion. It's fun. Sometimes I'll tell people, yeah, this is a traditional Appalachian briefcase. Those old mountain men, when they went down to town to see their brokers, is what they carried. And I'm trying. I'm trying to figure some way to make these so that I could sell them, because I think, you know, they'd be nice, but they're very labor intensive. I've not learned a fast way to do them. So it's in the meantime, what I'm doing, what's going on with this is, I mean, I'm able to carry this anytime I have like notebooks and stuff like that and papers, is I'm just kind of working out the prototype. Well, I found out this little latch didn't quite work, so I had to drill a hole in it and make a little peg to latch it. And you know, I found out the hickory bark doesn't work on here because it works and then eventually breaks. And so I'm in the process, this is like in the process of experimenting, and I'm just sort of carry it and see what sort of abuse it can take. Seems really good. Now, speaking of abuse, okay. So I decided, I've been seeing those pack baskets. In fact, I bought one years ago, one of those made out of rattan and birch veneer. I bought it in a hardware store in Maine when I decided I was going to be a nerve man. And so then I decided, okay, well, I learned how to do that ash, and I made this out of a combination of ash. There's some basswood bark in it because I ran out of ash splints, and started using it. And I thought, now, the real beauty in this thing is that it really works, that you can use it, you can throw it on your pack. And a lot of times the sort of stuff I do when I'm doing performing and stuff like that, I go visit schools, and a lot of times I have to fly. Well, I don't want to go carry go to all this trouble to make something that can really carry my stuff and really be comfortable. I mean, you know, carrying a suitcase is the worst thing in the world. If you can throw something on your back, you can just go on, and you can walk much further. You don't have to take cabs. You don't have, you know, it makes it easier to live in the 20th century world. Okay, well, the problem is, okay, you put one, you come up to the airlines with this, right? And the first thing, all right, well, you know, you don't have a top for that. Okay, so I had to make a top. Okay, so then I found out, they say, all right, sign this disclaimer here. And anyone who tries to fly with a guitar knows about this. That what they do is they make you sign a disclaimer that if it's non-traditional luggage, you know, like you can have a cheesy thing made out of cardboard, and it's insured up to $500. You come in with a rugged basket or something that's non-traditional, and sign a disclaimer. That means they're not responsible for the luggage, you know, arrive damaged, they'll say receive damaged or whatever. And that means that they said, you know, the guys that are loading, they see, disclaimer. Yeah. You know, so they can treat it worse, you know, rather than better. So I decided, all right, I'm gonna make one let you kick it around. Let's see what can happen. And okay, so I made a basket and so I made the top for this, and I made a rig that I can rig this across here with some nylon strapping because it was the best material available. I went to a backpack store and I made it so I can strap this thing on there. And so it's sort of part of like a 20th century challenge. How can you really deal in a traditional and still, yet it's still better than a suitcase because you can carry it on your back. So it's none of this stuff, you know. So I made some strapping to put across the top of it. And then I found it. So then sure enough, you'll see it, and you'll see them, they'll pick it up, and they'll pick it up like this. And you'll see them carrying it across, and it'll come on to arrive, coming out on the thing, upside down. And it's like, all right. So then, next challenge, you know. And again, this is dealing with the 20th century world, you know. I mean, this is the world we live in, right? So I made a deal so I could take these. So I put this waist belt on there. A waist belt makes it even easier to carry. And I'm playing, so the waist belt. So I take the waist belt and I strap the waist belt around here. That pads it extra. And then I take these two straps, I tie them up around the top and weave them so they can carry a strap. And it takes me about 15 minutes or maybe 5 or 10 minutes to rig that up. So the only place they can pick it up is by the handle. And the top's on there. And what was interesting is the first time that I got this system perfected. I mean, usually it's like I just feel like such a nuisance. You know, I mean, you know, they have that way of just kind of digging into it. You're being weird, boy, you're a nuisance. Is the time that I had it fixed up right, so that it was rugged, and the top was on it, and it was secure. The first thing Lady said, "My, what a beautiful piece of luggage!"
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, but the same person that would go, you know, but like. Immediately, someone who had no relationship with baskets or anything, immediately she saw it, and she saw the integrity of it. And so in a way, that told me that I'd made it, you know? Okay, well now, another interesting thing, this is the stuff that's most excited me lately, so that's why I don't mind blabbering about it here. So now the one thing is that the Adirondack pack basket, the general way they rig them is they generally have a strap going around here, and then they have two straps that come down underneath, and they become your shoulder straps. Now, I had that one I had, what thing was interesting is that I carried it around a lot. And what would happen is with all that weight pulling, it had a strap there, and with all that weight pulling, it would tend to push the bag, the basket. And as it got worn and more used, it would sort of pull it lopsided, and it would tend to crush in the sides. And besides, without having a, oh Lord, it's all falling apart now. with just carrying just on your shoulders, any of you who do backpacking, you know that carrying something just on your shoulders is just awful. I mean, it works for a while, but it just really gets on you. So I realized that I really needed something that I could really use backpacking. I mean, like, I don't mind carrying a pound or two of aesthetics if it's balanced right, you know. I mean, this may weigh a pound or more than a backpack. So I spent a month last winter trying to work out this little prototype. And so I realized that to have a good backpack, what you need, anyone who carries backpacks know that you want your weight up high, the heaviest weight. So I wanted to make a backpack that would come up and be wider on the top. You'll sometimes see in third world countries, a lot of their backpacks that they carry are cone shaped. So I decided I wanted a basket that would come up and be bigger on the top, and I wanted one that would fit my back, that would be tailor made, like the state of the art in backpacks these days are those, what are they, they don't have a frame, they have internal frame packs, and they actually bend a piece of metal so that it'll fit your back. So I made a frame for this thing that would kind of fit my back, and then I don't know if you've been around the backpacking world, but they've just rediscovered the wheel. The backpackers with all their fancy rigs and all, what they discovered is one of the best ways of carrying is, of course, the third world time eternal method of the old tump line. So really, you don't need any of this rigging. And what this does is this pulls your weight right on down. So I rigged this up so it would work on the side of the pack, and then you can, of course, always use the strap. It's not good for scenery, you know. You got a long hill, all right. And then also build it up so that you have your
safety belt.
You know, yeah, right, safety belt. No, but the idea, if you can carry it on your waist, you know, if you have something carried on your waist, your legs are much stronger than the rest of your body. So then this way you can use all three systems, you know, and I've used this a fair amount, and it seems to be working. So I'm all excited about it as a prototype, although I can't imagine making another one.
of basket making and technology.
That's not going to be available in Kmart.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Well, we've hit 9:30, which I think is a good long time for discussion. I want to leave Doug a little time to tell us some stories. So maybe we ought to call this to a close and ask, let's take maybe four or five questions. If you've got questions you want to ask these people, and then let's call it quits. Go ahead.
Have you ever tried, ran into a basket not as nifty as that last year up in upstate New York, and I found that my one-year-old thought that was the greatest way to see the world ever.
In the basket.
Yeah. So when you get it all rigged up, put a little kid in.
Right, and they
nest down the bottom of the tire. Uh-huh. And walk up and see the world.
Great.
Try that one. Nifty.
Are you all interested in looking at older baskets that were made 50, 60, 70 years ago?
Love
do you all
it.
Do that?
Love it.
We look.
Bring them up.
I shall.
Good.
They always look.
Sure.
Question. Have all of you ended up moving to someplace other than where you were born and grew up?
We have. Both of us.
I have.
Bill? Yeah, okay. I was just curious. I don't know if it means anything, but...
Yeah. We're sort of talking about passing on a tradition to people who don't come from that tradition.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a quirky part of this, I think, but it's part of the, it seems to be part of the American system that people move around a lot.
Yeah.
And I think we have to accept the fact that the passing on of tradition doesn't have to go straight in the community, straight down the lines in the community.
Yeah.
But tradition is a tradition regardless of who takes it up and carries it on. Johnny?
I know that Bill grew up using a lot of hand tools and things like that. I want to ask Connie and Tom and also Doug, did you grow up in a community where, you know, using a pocket knife and hand tools and stuff like that was common, or did you grow up in the suburbs like I did where you had to learn it when you were 20 years old or 25 and it was wasn't as easy as it is for your 5-year old now that has been handling tools all his life.
I grew up in basically the suburbs. I never really looked at a basket until I moved to West Virginia, and I was about 20, 21, something like that. I never knew what a pocket knife was until I sat down to make a basket. So
you look like a lot of Bill's students after you finish your first basket.
I didn't even sit flat. It just kind of rocked there. It was nowhere.
Bill's got a reputation in town now for a Memorial General Hospital.
We helped him too.
He sent a few over ourselves. Mm-hmm.
We get commission from the hospital. The A&A company. All sewn up.
I might say that my father was a tradesman. He was a plumber. And I started in, of course, because I was old enough to go in the truck. So I did have some experience using tools, not woodworking tools.
Tom's
hands-on kinds of working.
He can do stuff.
Pipe wrench, threading.
Right, sure.
Yeah, my dad showed me pocket knife stuff. I had a pocket knife.
So you were pretty handy as you were growing up.
Yeah.
It seems to me that some of this business of just being used to working with your hands adapts to different processes very readily.
Well, there is one thing about our background I think that is important. That both of our families were independent businessmen. Mm-hmm. And there's two sides of this thing, being a craftsman. One is working with your hands, and the other is running a business. And as everybody here can say, that's a big part of it. Connie and I both come from families of independent businessmen. So.